Leith, you've referred to investors in Sydney in particular as going hog wild. The question from here is how much further can they go? How much more of the market can they take?
That's a million-dollar question, and I guess my response would be, how long's a piece of string? I mean, this madness, I thought, had finished in 2010, and I thought that, we'd probably never hit the kind of valuations relative to incomes, rents, whatever. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't say never, but not for, decades at least, hit those sort of valuations again, and yet here we are. Bubbles can last longer than you expect, and they're certainly not based on rationality. And it could run for another year, or maybe even another 18 months, who knows? Or it could start finishing up in 6 months, we just don't know. And you'd be a pretty brave person to actually put a precise date on it. I quite frankly don't know. I mean, it is nuts. The investor mortgage demands that it's pretty much the highest level ever, particularly in places like Sydney and Melbourne. It could go for a while yet, and if it does, it's just going to make the ultimate decline worse. Particularly as obviously we've got stiff headwinds for employment and also incomes as the mining investment boom and commodity price boom unwinds, and also we've got the chattering in the local car industry by 2017. It really is a toxic mix.
Lindsay, you were speaking earlier about what you saw as the sensitivity of Australians to discussion about real estate. Do you think that feeds into media coverage of real estate issues like those that Leith's referring to with investors?
When a country gets caught up in something, it really does. And this is a very clear reflection of the last several years of this long-term boom. In the last several years, I mean, the way we talk about property, it only goes up. And it's instilled in the mindset here that it only does go up, which is quite concerning because the reality is the laws of economics say things go up and down. And once again, you've got to look at just the mindset here in Australia. It's very hard to persuade people here that there could be a property bubble. And the only way a lot of people here are probably going to realise that is when it's too late. And just as Leith was saying, it's very hard to depict when something like this turns for the worst because you do need a trigger. You need something like the banks unwilling to lend more to home buyers than they did the year before, or you need something like China realising that if they keep on constructing that they're going to build more apartments than people one day. So with Australia being so highly leveraged, which Australians through the media don't really realise that, you don't need much to create a house of cards moment, and that's a scary fact. I heard the other day there was an analyst saying, well, we could expect an increase of, just 3%, which is very modest. I mean, a 3% increase in a place like Sydney is $24,000 on the average house, which is pretty close to 30% of household income increase. So especially in the mainstream, there's only a handful of young journalists out there trying to bring, certain aspects to attention.
David, you've long made the point that the international borrowings of Australia's banks to fund domestic mortgages have great implications for the stability of the Australian financial system. What sort of things should we be looking for when thinking about whether the system is or isn't stable?
Well, I think we're seeing those points every day now. As I said earlier, Moody's has warned twice, once on the inherent risk in investor mortgages and second time on offshore borrowing. So, those are the kind of warnings that you will see repeated again and again that's telling you that the system is leveraging up again in the same way it did in the lead up to 2008. And then you've got to ask yourself, where does that end? Chris Joy is out here saying the only way this can possibly end is through either rate rises or macroprudential. I'm not sure I entirely agree with that. I think it could end, we could certainly end with an external shock, as Lindsay says, where, if China or the US equity and debt markets, run into an accident or stall, then you get a flow-on effect into global borrowing costs, and suddenly the local banks' wholesale borrowing costs are prohibitive, and you rerun 2008. We also went through it in 2011 with the European crisis, but they managed to kind of manage through it because we're in the middle of the mining boom. So, I mean, at some point you get that external shock. Alternatively, we do have a supply side boomlet going. I'm not sure it's necessarily in the right areas. It's kind of driven a lot by external demand rather than local. But that is starting to weigh quite heavily on rents, which are falling in some areas, but certainly stalled in a lot of areas. You also have the mining boom states where property is going to fall as the headwinds from the mining CapEx cliff really start to crunch in the next 12 months, and that could spook the market a little and slow it down. All of these things are the signs that the cycle is aging. you know, when does it kind of reach old age and die? I don't know. I suspect that the global business cycle will, you know, if we manage through the Chinese property bust that's underway right now, you know, for the next 18 months, then I think the US will run out of puff in probably 2016 in its own kind of share market and debt market bubbles. So there isn't that much longer to go in the global business cycle. They tend to run for about 8 years. So, I mean, the upside in it is not terrific. But basically, I think that this is probably the final leg in what has been, you know, virtually a 15-year bubble. And the reason I say that, and I haven't said it before, you know, for instance, in 2009, I was quite comfortable that property prices weren't going to tumble, same in 2010, even though some thought otherwise. The reason why was because we had a lot of policy ammunition to protect it. You know, we had oodles of interest rate scope and a very clean public balance sheet. But now, you know, only 3 or 4 years on, we've nearly exhausted monetary policy. And, you know, if house prices were to start to fall, what difference would a couple more rate cuts make at this point? And more importantly still, with the headwinds, the macro headwinds outside of housing, the budget is really going to struggle to return to surplus. And S&P has warned that it will strip the AAA rating if we breach 30% net debt to GDP. We're currently at about 21. I don't think we're going to get much lower than that before we enter the next global shock. That will send us straight through 30% within a year as automatic stabilizers and stimulus kick in and we lose the AAA. Now, that's the keystone in the Australian credit arch is not the banks, it's the public balance sheet and the AAA rating, because those guarantees flow through to the bank's borrowing costs and their own credit ratings. So for me, that's the real critical event, and I don't think there's any way of avoiding losing that AAA in the next external shock or during the process in the aftermath. So for me, the system is exhausting itself, and we're probably on the last leg.
Can I just follow on from one of the points you make there? Would you say that the increased borrowing by Australia's banks on international markets to fund domestic mortgages needs to be matched by increased budget austerity by the government?
Yeah, I mean, it's what I describe as the growth straitjacket. You know, the more that the banks try to push externally funded debt into housing, exactly as you say, you know, the more the government is required to boost the public balance sheet to guarantee that borrowing. And as you can see, it's actually a system of declining return over time.
But what are the options for the government and the RBA in terms of getting out of the growth straitjacket?
Well, the one thing that they should have done and could still do is macroprudential. But, you know, there's this kind of policy paralysis that seized the RBA and APRA for whatever reason. You know, some of it is groupthink. Some of it is just bureaucratic arse-covering. Some of it, I think they, you know, guys like John Edwards just genuinely believe that, you know, a rainbow is going to hit us in the arse every time there's trouble. So, like, we've been on an incredible run for 23 years and it's generated a complacency that kind of self-fulfilling. So what will they do? I just don't think they can do much. I mean, you know, they're clearly not going to do anything explicitly macroprudential, I don't think, anymore. I thought they would, but I'm now quite doubtful. They can't raise rates, you know, with all of those external or macro headwinds that Lise described, the mining investment cliff, the catastrophe that's unfolding in manufacturing, the wrecking ball, as Ross Garnett puts it, going through the tradable sectors on the high dollar, the correction that's coming in Chinese growth. I mean, there's no way they can raise rates, and so they've kind of, you know, cast the die for this one last shot at housing-driven growth, and it looks like they're going to have to just drive it to its ultimate conclusion.
I can also just add that we're obviously heaping a bit of mud at the RBA here, but, you know, we shouldn't absolve Australia's governments from blame as well. I mean, you know, the RBA's got a pretty limited tool set. They certainly haven't been strong enough in jawboning the government, but, you know, we do have a ridiculously distorted tax system. We've got state governments who act, obviously, make supply less responsive and at least at the affordable end of the market. And, you know, we certainly shouldn't absolve them of blame too. The governments here don't seem to care. They're ignoring the issue. They're just basically letting it rip.
And that takes us very nicely in the direction of politics. Lindsay, you've recently identified that Australia's politicians have between them, both sides of politics, a $300 million investment property portfolio. Do you think that makes them issue blind or subject deaf on the subject of the risks of Australia's real estate investment plunge or even housing affordability?
Yeah, I mean, look, you'd have to look at it. Just as concerning is that such a large portion of them have a home loan. So the mere fact here that property and real estate just seems to be one of those topics that all politicians seem to be 100% in full marriage about. They will fight about a million things in Parliament, but one thing they don't seem to fight about is property. And that's scary because it is pretty clear that the politicians, every time they've added a stimulus to the real estate sector, you get this property price explosion and you get this explosion on the assets of the balance sheet of our banking system. So there's not many more levers they have to try and keep this bubble going up unless they let first home buyers tap into their super, which could leave them with no retirement in taking on a high-risk loan. So I'm very concerned when you do see the policy mindset that the politicians from all parties, this is not just a Labor or Liberal or Greens thing, it's all of them, you know, what are they going to do? Or are they going to make some sort of desperate attempt to try and keep property prices going up? And if they do so and property prices do go up, all we know is people are going to be taking on, new home buyers are just going to be taking on a lot more leverage than they already are today, which no one else in the Western world is doing.
That idea about using superannuation to fund housing deposits, that does seem to have raised its ugly head again. Leith, can you just run over why it isn't such a great idea in case, say, Senator Xenophon happens to listen in?
Yeah, well, basically, as Sol Escalate showed, without a shadow of doubt, is that demand-side measures don't work, boosting housing affordability. All it does is add demand to the market, put a rocket under prices, increase prices more, and it's self-defeating. And what Sol Escalate showed is that despite all the first homeowners grants, the massive reduction in interest rates, and all the other sort of props to the housing market, the rate of home ownership's been falling and is actually at its lowest level for 50 years. And all that allowing buyers to access the super funds is likely to do is obviously suck out retirement savings, add further demand, push up house prices even more, and we're going to be in an even worse affordability situation down the track. And we're going to have even more of the nation's capital ploughed into the non-productive housing market, which isn't particularly good use of the nation's funds. And it just creates even more resource misallocation into housing, and we've already got enough of that.
David, do you see any likely political response to real estate and housing affordability?
No. You've only got to see what's going on. The one great hope is David Murray's inquiry, which, you know, I've given a bit of a panning, given its conflicts of interest. But if you look through its preliminary documents, there are some good ideas in there, as well as some bad ones. But that's not really about housing affordability. It's about, obviously, the banking system, the future of it. But if David Murray's good to his word and they pursue reform targeting increased resilience in the banking sector as opposed to what everyone else wants, which is how to fund the future, which is code for borrowing offshore to put in houses, then we will intrinsically be addressing affordability if he does it. You know, the other stuff that's in the pipe, the foreign investor inquiry, I think is likely to throw up a whole bunch of really interesting headline proposals that do absolutely nothing, when the answer is very clearly and very simply to ask real estate agents to check on residency. That won't be pursued, I don't think. Instead, they'll go for fines and all sorts of extravagant stuff that will never be policed. And it'll be very deliberate. You know, I christened this whole system a few years ago the Politico Housing Complex. I think a lot of the operatives within it are quite cynical and know exactly what they're doing. So I do think that when the next downturn comes, especially if it's associated with an external shock, we'll probably see a renewed first home buyers grant. But even that will have nothing whatsoever to do with affordability. You know, that'll simply be another stimulus measure really designed to prop up prices. And as I've already said in this discussion, I think that will ultimately fail because we're coming to the end of our firepower anyway. But basically, the system doesn't want lower house prices. The banks, the government, the RBA, maybe or maybe not APRA, they're all in it. They're all in it together. They've all got a legacy to protect. The banks, you know, obviously falling house prices represent a clear and present danger to the stability of the banks. And the government doesn't want to rock the boat. The alternative way, sort of model for the economy, which is to pursue externally driven demand, you know, grow your exports, is a much harder path to take. It really requires the entire country to knuckle down and innovate their asses off and to make sacrifices for the common good. No government wants to do that when they can just simply sign off on higher house prices and pretend they're good economic managers.